This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today we read from a story in the May 1987 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Prayers of a Rain God by Richard Paul Russo. Janet watched him tremble in the moonlight slanting through the window. Garrett was dreaming again, the same vision that now repeated 3 or 4 times a week. She could tell from his constricted face, the sweat on his neck, and the abrupt, irregular gasps as if he were short of breath. They pray to him for rain. Disembodied, he hovers above them, above the vast expanse of barren rock and sand, dirt mounds, a dying forest in the distance. The sun is fierce, leaching all moisture from the air. A few thin plants still grow, spindly and brittle. A dry riverbed weaves through rock and sand, then flows into what was once an enormous lake. Several tiny pools of water remain scattered about the riverbed and the lake, and the abandoned hulls of several small sailing vessels lie on the sloping beach. Here, at the mouth of the dry river, they have gathered, 50 or 60 in number, and they pray to him. They are not human, but clearly intelligent, bipedal, lightly furred in varying shades of rust, orange, tan. One, the tallest, is dark black. They stand at the edge of the barren lake and raise their faces to him. Their eyes are small, recessed, their noses long, stiff, and narrow. If there are ears, they are hidden among the tufts of fine fur covering their heads. Their narrow mouths open and close as they speak to him. Some raise their long, gangly arms to the sun and sky, fingers outstretched. In their gestures and in their faces, he recognizes their supplication to him, their God. They are dying, his people. They whisper and sing at the river mouth, praying to him for rain and for life. Garrett woke in a panic, his throat dry and constricted. He gasped for breath in the darkness, reached out frantically, and tossed the sheet and blanket from him. Janet gripped his hand and held it to her breast. "Garrett," she whispered, "it's okay. I'm here." Her voice soothed and eased away the fear. He turned, and in the light of the moon could see her face, the smooth skin, her large eyes gazing at him. She released his hand and wiped at the sweat on his forehead. "Water?" she said. Garrett nodded. He swung his arms over the side of the bed and sat up. A slight tremor went through his hand, then faded. He filled the tumbler with water from the glass pitcher he'd begun to keep on the nightstand. Moonlight reflected through the clear water, and Garrett quickly drained the glass. He refilled it, drank down the chilled water, and replaced the glass on the nightstand. He was still thirsty, but felt bloated and queasy. Garrett looked out through the lace curtains at the nearly full moon. He could not shake the feelings of dread and responsibility and guilt. "The dream?" Janet asked. "No dream," he answered. The exchange was becoming tense ritual. Janet persisted in calling them dreams, and he refused to give them that name. Garrett pulled open the window and let in the cold night air. He still felt the heat of the parched world drawing moisture from him. Maybe it was time to go back into space, just a short trip back to the moon, or even a shuttle up to one of the stations, something to give him some perspective. He shook his head. Perspective on what? People, intelligent beings, were dying on some other world, and a trip to the moon wasn't going to help them. Nothing would. except rain. It was early evening, but Garrett was already in bed. Janet sat in the kitchen drinking tea. She considered fixing a drink, a Jack on the rocks, but she really didn't want one. She turned on the small table radio, tuned into a classical station. Something she didn't recognize, as usual, was playing. The quiet music was just loud enough so that she would not hear Garrett snore or toss in the bed. Janet wondered if he would have the dream again, his vision. She didn't know what to think about it anymore. His dreams had driven them apart from each other, though they both fought to remain close. She felt she was fighting a losing battle. There had always been a distant quality to Garrett, even before they were married. Janet had often felt his mind was partially attuned to the world around him, that part of his thoughts were somewhere else, in another room, another city, on some other world. It seemed quite appropriate that he had chosen the space program for a career, that he had striven to become an astronaut, and she had not been surprised at his success. So Garrett had begun to go into space, making several trips a year to the two stations and the moon, training hard and long as plans were made to venture to Mars and beyond. Janet had little trouble adjusting to his long absences. They seemed a natural part of Garrett's makeup, and she was busy herself teaching German at State. There was no real distance between them, and his trips into space had put up no new barriers. Then came the second Mars mission, which had gone smoothly, a huge success. Garrett was part of it, had been gone nearly 2 years, and came back home to her relatively unchanged until the dreams began. Now she felt him drifting completely away from her despite their efforts. He had become obsessed with his visions. Janet looked at the wall clock. It was nearly 11. She turned off the radio, put her mug in the sink, and went into the bedroom. Garrett was sleeping peacefully on his side, one arm on top of the blankets, his head between the two pillows. If he was dreaming, it was a normal dream. She undressed, put on her knee-length nightshirt, and crawled into bed next to him. She turned onto her side, her back to him, and eased against his body. In his sleep, he moved closer so their bodies fit snugly together and put one arm over her that she held to her breast, both hands clasped around his fingers. As she drifted into sleep, she let the silent tears dip freely onto the pillow. The drought continues. The sun and the heat remain. The people below him, these intelligent furred beings, move slowly about their village near the dry riverbed. He can now distinguish males from females, though the differences were not immediately obvious. Their dwellings are made of wood and stone, small rectangular structures built against rock mounds or small hillocks. Several large cooking pits are spaced regularly among the buildings. Most of the cooking pits seem to be abandoned. The distant forest is now a skeletal maze of thin, dried trunks and branches without leaves. Occasionally, a small, light-skinned animal scurries over the ground, hurrying from shelter to shelter. Scattered about in all directions are the skeletons of larger animals, the bones clean and bleached. No carcasses remain, no shred of meat or skin on any of them. A few of his people wander in the riverbed, searching for food or small pools of water. One male, the single black-furred being, searches farther upstream and periodically pokes a long digit into the dry bed, feeling for moisture. Towards noon, most activity ceases. All members of the village gather lethargically at the riverbed, then amble slowly towards the lake. As they walk, many of them ruffle the fur around their necks and under their arms, an apparent attempt to keep cool. At the lake's edge, they form patterns all facing the dry lake bed. The younger ones form a double row in front, each an arm's length from those on either side. The adults then form two half circles behind them, the black-furred one in the center of the back row. A chant begins from the children and is taken up by the adults. The dark one reaches up to the sky, reaches up to his god and howls, his voice cracked and anguished. Several others raise their arms, and the prayer increases in intensity. "I want to bring you rain," Garrett thinks. "I am trying." But he knows they do not hear his thought, and he feels helpless. What good is a god who can do nothing for his people? Of what use is a god who lets his people die? He and Janet walked through the eastern end of Golden Gate Park on a Monday afternoon. Overhead, dark clouds rolled past, threatening rain. Garrett and Janet were dressed warmly in coats, scarves, and boots. In the nearly deserted children's playground, they sat on a bench facing the main play area. Two boys, about 7 or 8 years old, and bundled up in parkas and mittens, moved unsteadily across a bridge of chains and tires, while a woman stood nearby, watching and smoking a cigarette. "You need to do something," Janet said. "It's getting worse, not better. You don't sleep enough at night anymore. You're always tired." "All right, for now it's okay, but when you leave is over and you have to go back." She stopped and shrugged. "It's not doing a hell of a lot for our relationship either." Garrett closed his eyes and leaned his head back. He tried to will the clouds overhead to open, release a downpour or at least a drizzle. No water fell. "I know they seem like dreams to you," he said. He felt for her and put his hand on her knee. "I'd probably think that's all they were, except..." He opened his eyes, sat up, and looked at her. "There's too damn much logic to them, and a regular pattern. If they were simply repetitive, but they aren't. The drought goes on. Everything is drying out, getting worse. Each dream is a slight progression from the previous, and they never go back. I can't believe dreams could do this over such a long period of time." Janet pushed both hands into her coat pockets. What else could they be? Visions? A door into another reality? Telepathic contact with another world? "Jesus, Garrett, we've been through all this before and none of it makes any sense. Every idea sounds absurd." He stood and began to pace back and forth in front of the beach. Several times he started to speak but couldn't. He started to breathe and stopped pacing. "Look, something I haven't told you. The first time it happened, the first time I had this vision, whatever you want to call it, I was not asleep. I was awake and I wasn't dreaming." He paused. But she remained silent, waiting. "I was not even here on Earth." He started to pace again. "It was just after we'd burned out of orbit from Mars. I was awake. We were all awake. Suddenly I was there, on this strange world above the world, looking down on drying streams that had obviously once been rivers, on a pond that had once been a large lake, on a dying forest, looking down on a dying race of intelligent beings. It went on a long time, hours, it seemed, as I watched these alien creatures moving through their world, trying to survive. And when it ended and I was back in the ship, no one had noticed a thing. Practically no time had passed. I hadn't gone into any kind of trance, and I sure hadn't been asleep to dream. He stood watching the two boys who had stopped playing on the bridge and were wrestling in the sand. It began to rain lightly, and he found it difficult to turn around. Janet said, "You didn't tell anyone, did you?" He looked directly at her. It was hard, but he managed it. A few strands of hair were wet and pressed against her face. Her face was so clean and smooth, and her eyes were so large and open. Water dripped from her hair. "The craziest thing," he began, "the hardest thing, the most absurd part of all this is that they were praying. They were praying to me, their God." He looked down at his open hands, then back at her. "I am their God." Janet stood in the rain, watching, waiting for her to respond. After several minutes, she stood, put her arm through his, and pressed tightly. "Let's go home," she said. They had not spoken for hours. After coming in from the rain and showering separately, Janet had fixed up a fire while Garrett worked on dinner. She sat in front of the fire with a Heinrich Ball novel and sipped at a Jack Daniels. The flames drew her gaze, and she spent more time staring at them than reading. She didn't know what to think about Garrett. He was not an irrational man. He was not given to mysticism or astrology or beliefs in paranormal powers, dreams that foretold the future, or anything like that. If anything, he was a skeptic in the true sense of the word. He questioned everything, always with an open mind, but needing to be logically convinced. Garrett just did not take anything on faith. And yet, it was clear he believed what he said, because it deeply caused him pain. Garrett came into the front room and sat in the chair closest to Janet. She put the book aside and looked at him. "I made a casserole," he said. "Should be ready in about an hour." He breathed deeply once. "Janet, do you think we've never discussed one explanation? We've discreetly avoided it," he said, smiling. "But do you think I've lost touch with reality, that I've lost my sanity? Do you believe that?" "No." The answer was firm and sure. "I don't think so either," Janet said, "but it is a possibility and has to be considered." He nodded, and they were silent for a long time. Janet sipped at her drink and finished it, while Garrett stared into the dying fire. He got up from the chair and added a log. "A god?" she said. Garrett shrugged. "I know how it sounds, but I am a presence above them, and they are praying to me." He stood and turned to her. "I know it, Janet, deep in my gut. There is no doubt in me. I may not be helping them, but they are praying to me, and I am their God." Janet slowly shook her head. "You're a human being, Garrett. You don't have any special powers. Isn't it more likely that you have made some kind of contact and are just observing this world?" He looked away and into the fire. "You think I want to be a god? You think I have a choice?" The silence returned. Janet shook her head slowly, watching him. "You are not a god," she said. For the first time, it is night. He can barely distinguish the outlines of the village dwellings below. In the dim moonlight, it appears that most of the villagers are asleep. A huge fire burns in the riverbed. Tending the fire is the tall, black-furred being. He is placing the ends of long pieces of wood into the fire, forming a circle of the pieces around the edges. The ends seem to be coated with something flammable, for as each one is placed into the fire, a small burst of flame and sparks erupts from it. 50 or 60 of these lengths of wood ring the fire. The dark one picks up one of the lengths, a torch now, with one end burning brightly, and walks along the riverbed, downstream 20 paces. He plants the torch in the dry earth. The torch burns steadily, flames tossing slightly in a breeze. He returns to the fire, picks up another piece, and carries it farther downstream, where he plants it as far from the first as the first is from the fire. The next time, he picks up two torches and plants them still farther downstream, one at a time, equally spaced. The lone figure continues the procedure, carrying two torches at a time, hiking farther downstream with each trip to plant them. From above, it seems the course of the river is being slowly charted by fire, a long curving string of equidistant torches making the way. Eventually, the course of the riverbed is traced by fire all the way to the dry lake. Once the concluding torch is planted, the blackbird being returns to the fire, picks up as many of the torches as he can safely carry, then bears them to the edge of the lake. He plants them carefully in a small circle at the end of the line of torches. All the torches continue to burn without signs of fading. The lone dark figure paces about the circle of fire at the lake's edge, weaving from side to side. After a time, he steps inside the circle, raises arms and face to the sky, and howls. When there is no answer, he hangs his head, then suddenly drops to a kneeling position above a dark patch of earth within the flames and sticks a finger, then his entire hand into the ground. Wearily, he shakes his head from side to side, then plunges his face and mouth to the ground. He buries his face deeper, deeper, then abruptly pulls free and stares up at the night sky. His mouth, nose, and tiny eyes are covered with dry, dry sand. The dark one rises slowly to his feet, holds out two open palms, then violently spits into the sand at his feet. Garrett woke coughing, unable to breathe. He pushed himself up into a sitting position, his mouth and throat dry and gritty. He gasped for air and felt Janet reach for him as he continued to cough. After a minute or two, the coughing subsided and he breathed easier. Garrett wiped his mouth and felt sand on his fingers. He looked down at his hand, then felt the inside of his mouth with his tongue, more sand. He turned and saw flecks of sand on his pillow, the sheet. He held out his hand to Janet, thrusting at her. Sand! Tell me this isn't real. I've got sand in my mouth, down my throat, and where the hell did it all come from? From a godforsaken world, that's where. He pounded his hand on the pillow and turned from her to pick up the water pitcher, started to fill his glass, then stopped and stared at the pitcher, at the clear, bright water. Rage and frustration swelled inside him, pressuring for release, and for the first time in his life, he was afraid he would take it out on Janet. He swung the pitcher back, then heaved it violently against the far wall. The glass shattered and water sprayed over the wall and floor. Garrett buried his head in his hands and sat on the edge of the bed for a long time, pressing his palms as hard as possible against his skull. Garrett had almost completely stopped talking to her. She had tried to offer another explanation for the sand, that they were near the park and sandy ground, but he would not listen. He spent most of the days out walking, though Janet did not know where he went. He napped in the afternoons, went to bed quite early, and slept late. He stopped fixing meals, so Janet took over the cooking, though Neither of them ate much any longer. Garrett had the dreams every time he slept now, and she felt he was trying to remain permanently asleep in a constant state of dreaming. She nearly moved out twice, certain she could not take it any longer, but had been unable to leave him alone. Now, she simply waited for it to stop, or for Garrett to deteriorate to a point where he would need to be committed somewhere for care. Then, one day, he did talk to her at length. She was taken by surprise. Garrett had built up a fire himself, then asked her to come into the front room so he could talk to her. His tone and manner seemed rational, as if nothing odd were happening to him. "First," he began, "I want to apologize. I can imagine what you've been through, and you don't deserve it. But I can't do anything about it. I'm not going to try to convince you that anything's going to change. Nothing will. If anything, this is all going to get worse. Do you know of something that's going to happen?" Garrett shook his head. "No, you probably won't understand, but I wouldn't end this now, even if I could. Not in the way you're thinking. I feel responsible for lives. They are dying because of me." Janet closed her eyes and shook her head. She did not want to go into that anymore. "All right," Garrett said. "I'll let that part of it be. But there is one thing I need to say, something I need you to promise me." Janet opened her eyes and looked at him. "Go ahead." "If anything happens to me and I end up on a hospital on life support machines or something like that, well, I know we've talked about this before, and we both felt we didn't want to be kept alive by machines, not in the long run, that if one of us were in that position, we would want the other to have the doctors disconnect the life support systems." "What's going to happen, Garrett?" "I don't know, I told you. But if something does, I want you to promise me you won't have them disconnect the life support. I want to be kept alive. I have to be kept alive." "Garrett, tell me what's going to happen. Promise me, Janet." "Garrett!" "Janet." They lapsed into silence. After a long time, Janet nodded to him. "Yes," she said silently, "I promise." The promise received, Garrett stood and went into the bedroom. Janet sat watching the fire, drained and empty, certain now that she had finally lost him. "He has done it, almost." High white clouds moved serenely across the sky, and the furred beings stagger out from their dwellings to stare up at the clouds. In shock, in awe, they lope down to the riverbed, stand in the middle, and face upstream as if expecting water to appear. The black-furred one remains aloof, staring up at the sky. There is no rain, no hint of moisture. Garrett has not managed that yet, and the solitary figure below him seems to recognize that. "Soon," Garrett thinks, "I promise." It is almost as if the Dark One hears him and does not believe, for once again he turns his head to the side and fiercely spits precious water to the ground before turning away from the sky and clouds to return to the village. The contact ceased. Garrett went into a low-key, barely contained panic. He had been gaining control over his sleep, more each day, so he was able to move at will in and out of the dream state that brought him to his world. He was even gaining control of the world itself, enough to create clouds, and before long, he would bring rain. He was certain of it. But now, he had planned to will himself into a permanent coma-like state, so he'd remain in constant contact with his world. Then he could fully become their God and save them. But if he could not get back, he could not bring them rain. They would die. He had to do something, and it had to be soon. But what had happened? What was wrong? There were no answers. Once again, Janet nearly moved out. Garrett's dreams had stopped, and for a few days she had hoped everything would return to normal. But instead, the situation worsened. Now Garrett had trouble getting to sleep for even an hour at a time. He started drinking more heavily, and while the drinking often put him to sleep, the sleep did not bring the dreams he wanted. The Seconals prescribed for him were no better, so he spent most of the days half drunk, trying to sleep, occasionally jogging or running to tire himself out. Nothing worked. But Janet stayed. She stayed, and she kept the house together, cooked and made sure he ate, and held him when he burst into tears of frustration, mumbling about the deaths he was causing. Janet became convinced Garrett had finally lost touch with reality, but still she could not bring herself to have him carted away like some helpless animal. Then, one day, he stopped drinking and stopped taking the sleeping pills. He still spoke only infrequently to her, but he started eating more regularly, began to exercise, and stopped trying to sleep all day. Both physically and mentally, Garrett seemed to be pulling himself together, and when he had his first full night's sleep, undisturbed sleep in weeks, Janet began to think their ordeal was over. Then the dream returned. They are dying. One of the young ones is discovered dead beside a pile of rock, and the villagers gather around her. There is a hesitancy before acting, as if they are giving the young female a moment of mourning. The black-furred one whispers a few words, makes several motions in the air with his hands, then takes a knife and proceeds to cut into the dead youth. Two others hold bowls as the blood is drained, the precious liquid saved. When all the blood has been drained, the dark one begins to skin and carve the flesh. Garrett wants to stop looking, to turn away so he does not have to watch, but he cannot because he is their God, and a God sees all. A fire has been built in the nearest cooking pit, and a large grill has been set up over it. The villagers crowd around the fire. Smoke rises from the grill as the meat is placed upon it. Not once have any of his people looked up to him in either prayer or anger. It is as if he no longer exists. There are no clouds in the sky, no traces of moisture in the air. Garrett feels worthless again, an abandoned, impotent God. There was only one chance to save his people. Garrett had no time to regain control over his sleep and dream states. It would take weeks, and they would all be dead by then. He fingered one of the Seconal capsules spread out on the nightstand. He put it in his mouth, drank some water, and swallowed the capsule. Garrett swallowed another, then sat without moving for several minutes. He had worked it out as closely as had been possible. The amount of Seconal he would take should put him deeply into a coma, but as long as Janet acted quickly, it shouldn't kill him. Once in a coma, Garrett felt certain that at a subconscious level, he would be able to maintain the state. As long as he was hooked up to a life support system, he would be fine. Garrett swallowed more of the Seconals. He waited again, looking out the window at the dim light of the hidden quarter moon. Janet, that was what hurt most, what he had done to her and what she still had to go through. In the past few weeks, he had thought too little of her, had taken her for granted in many ways, if it could have been different, but he knew he did not have a choice. She was strong and she would survive, but this was the only chance his people had to survive. Garrett took the remaining seconals and finished off the water. He set the alarm clock and put the letter securely atop it. The letter was for Janet. It told her what he had done, what she had to do, and reminded her of her promise. He was beginning to feel drowsy, but that might be just his state of mind rather than the seconal. Garrett lay back on the bed and stared up at the ceiling. The room was cold, and he wrapped himself in an afghan. Eventually, his entire body began to feel heavy, as though he were sinking into the bed. He did not fight it, did not try to move or stay awake. It would be soon. He would bring rain to his people. Garrett felt quite certain of that now, and he welcomed the heavy drifting into sleep. He would bring rain, and he would save their lives. It is nearly dawn. Janet sat in the chair at the foot of the hospital bed, very much awake, though she had not slept all night. The lights on the wall monitors moved silently in regular patterns, blue, green, white. There were no red warning lights, no sounds indicating danger. Garrett's face looked relaxed, though occasionally it twisted as if he were in anguish. She could not tell if he was dreaming. She still did not believe he had been in contact with another world, but she hoped that, at least in his own mind, he had succeeded in getting there, and she would keep her promise to him, would never let them disconnect the life support systems as long as she had a choice. So she had adjusted to the distant quality about him when they had first met. Later, she had adjusted to his long absences during his space missions and training sessions, and now she would adjust to this as well, no matter how long it went on. When the sun made its first appearance in the window, Janet rose from the chair and left to return home to sleep. They are praying to him again. They are praying for the rain to stop. It has rained for 23 days now, without letting up day or night. The river is swollen, flooding periodically. The lake is already above its full level and still rising. The village has been washed away, and many of the villagers with it. Those who survive have moved away from the river and into the dead forest. But the forest, too, is flooding, and there is no solid earth on which to settle or build. The black-furred being is leading them all on a long trek towards higher land, but the nearest mountains are weeks away. It seems extremely unlikely that unless the rain stops, any of them will survive to reach even the foothills. Three times each day, the Dark One halts the march and leads the villagers in prayer. Garrett knows their prayers are useless. He has lost all control, if he ever really had any. Janet was right. He is not a god. He watches helplessly as his people die, as they pray in vain to him. They push on through earth that has become swamp, through newly formed lakes and rivers and uprooted trees, and each time they pray to him, Garrett prays as well. Prays to any god who can hear him, prays he will die so that his people will live. The rains continue to pour from the darkened sky. We conclude with a story from the summer 2024 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is What You Leave Behind by Ken Altabeth. The Haydar Pasha Cemetery was a gloomy place on the best of days, and today worse than ever. A gentle sea breeze brought the scents of cardamom and coriander
up from cargo ships on the pierhead below, but the trees on the hill, mostly ornamental stone pines and magnolia, remained eerily still. During the short walk from the car to her mother's gravesite, Hazal thought the grounds looked much busier than usual for a Wednesday. But of course it was an anniversary, if one could use that word for such a grim occasion. And so many had died on this day 20 years ago. She spread a small chenille cloth before the headstone to protect the hem of her dress from the loamy dirt and melt. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, she began. When she'd finished the first surah, she continued, O Allah, forgive our living and our dead, those who are present among us, and those who are absent. She paused. She could not recite Salat al-Janaza like this, but it didn't sound quite right with only one voice anyway. Hazal cast a self-conscious glance at the gravesite next to her left, where a middle-aged man knelt quietly by himself. She turned to the side and reached beneath her sweater, digging her fingertips into tender flesh as she hinged her ribcage open and drew out the disaster. The disaster, sharp-edged and still smoldering, singed her fingertips. Although only 6 inches across, it was quite heavy, and she quickly placed it on the ground beside the headstone, out of sight of the nearby mourners. She hated even to look at it, but she must. Here, in every detail, was a small section of Naqiyi Elgun Street, the front of the synagogue, its facade twisted and blown apart, flanked by whatever remained of the shops on either side, and the huge pile of debris in front. The fires, still burning even after 20 years, sent little wafts of black smoke into the air. She dispersed them with a wave of her hand before anyone else should notice. Search and rescue teams had already removed the bodies. There were no dead here anymore, save one. With her chest freed of the disaster's burden, Hazal took a fortifying breath of the chill November air. She felt so much lighter now, of course, but no less saddened. Even without the effigy inside her, she could not help but recall that fateful day 20 years ago. She had been 8 years old, walking with her mother down Nakaya Elgun Street. They had been shopping for groceries in the Nods, Hazal doing her part, carrying a little bag containing some figs, a half dozen eggs, and a small zucchini. Her mother looked askance at the strange truck parked in front of the synagogue as they passed, and quickened their pace, but didn't say anything. They were well beyond it when hell broke loose. The deafening roar, the searing heat, both were knocked to the ground. Hazal screamed as a piece of shrapnel sliced through her leg. She turned her mother over, pleading for help, but her mother had taken a fragment in the neck. So much blood. Her mother remained alive for a moment only, could not speak, just cast a desperately concerned glance at her daughter. In that final glance, Hazal hoped her mother saw that she was okay. The next day, still at the hospital, lost in a pit of black grief, she found the disaster residing in her chest. She felt its burn. She knew what it was. At that time, she was not capable of removing it. It sat there, wrapping her heart, smoldering on and on. It hurt. But in the following days and weeks, she found its torment oddly useful. She clung to it, despite the pain and the bitter stench in her nostrils, as she stood at the funeral, racked with sobs. She soon realized her father carried his own version of the disaster, though his appeared to be situated somewhat lower in the body. Yusuf grabbed his stomach at odd times, even groaning in distress, and ate very little. Soon his face had grown cadaverously thin, and his dry lips looked as if they might crack if he ever smiled again. She remembered him sitting at the kitchen table, breakfast of boiled eggs and yogurt, uneaten before him. "They kill Muslims when they try to kill Jews," he raged. He spat at the newspaper on the table, a little gob of saliva landing directly atop a photograph of bin Laden. 30 Al-Qaeda men were put on trial for the series of 4 synagogue burnings in Istanbul during 2003. Hazal was too young to care. In the years that followed, she felt no solace. There were always those who got away, those who fled to Iraq, those who had given the orders. She had never felt a sense of justice for the dead, for her mother, for any of it. For the next several months, it felt as if they remained frozen in time with nothing to say and mostly concerned with just breathing in and out the dimly lit apartment draped in a veil of tears. But then life went on. Hazal was heartbroken when her father would not let her have an iPhone. She lay on the bed half of the night crying, curled around the disaster. The pain was very sharp, the stench of the burning, charred flesh in her nostrils, and she realized an iPhone was not so important. Yusuf threw himself headlong into his work at the Directorate of Religious Affairs, managing a group of subsidiaries in the construction business for the Diyanet. When he eventually took another wife, replacing her mother with a much more traditional woman, she simply could not stand. Hazal was shocked. Rashida was nothing like her mother. She wore ever only drab robes and salwar so baggy they made her look like a nondescript blob of muddy colors. Her mother, in contrast, had championed a stylish, casual wardrobe featuring bright colors and flowered prints. Rashida had no interest in Hazal. She spoke very little outside of prayers. Her stepmother's presence, a constant irritant, Hazal retreated to her room and her studies, although her schoolwork was often replaced by lengthy interludes of sitting quietly in the corner, curled around the smoldering fires of Nakaye Elgun Street. When her father forbade her to see Kerem, a boy from the apartment 2 doors down, Hazal was devastated. Her father was so smug about it, pointing out that Kerem was half Pakistani, and worse, his family practiced at the Alawi Mosque rather than their own Sunni. "There's nothing between us, we're just friends," she insisted, although that was not strictly true. When her father became heated, Rashida said nothing. She simply threw a prayer to the left and the right. Hazal knew her real mother would have supported her cause, or at least helped Yusuf to see reason. But her real mother was gone. Nothing remained except a voiceless echo within the disaster, an effigy within an effigy. Despite the woman replacing her mother, Yusuf still didn't smile, not really, and Hazal could see there was tension between them. Rashida's cooking was exemplary, particularly when it came to baklava, and Yusuf had gained some weight, but his gains would never outpace the thing that was eating him from inside. At 18, Hazal snuck out of the apartment to attend the Gezi Park protests. Thousands of people had gathered, setting up a makeshift tent city in the park to support freedom of the press, the right of expression and assembly, and decry the burgeoning authoritarianism of Erdogan's regime. At the entrance to the park, someone gave her a hand-drawn map identifying various parts of the encampment and their pet causes: environmentalists, Kurds, socialists, even an LGBT section. Hazal made her way to the green area. A makeshift protester lending library had been set up there with hundreds of books, though Hazal didn't dare to take one. There were outdoor yoga classes and a free concert. Women wore bright summer dresses. Street vendors hawked fresh watermelon slices and plastic swimming goggles to protect against tear gas. It all seemed so wonderful to her. But Hazal stayed away, she only dared to, for a few hours. And upon her return home, Yusuf was furious. What if she'd been seen there? What if word got back to the Dianet? He became violent, striking her shoulders and back with a slender plastic ruler from his desk, his free hand clutching his belly. The blows stung, even through her clothes. A completely soulless look crossed his face, and she realized he acted not out of malice, but fear. Rashida said nothing. Hazal fled to her room and threw herself down on the bed, digging her fingertips into tender flesh. She hinged her ribcage and drew out the disaster. She threw it down, still smoldering on the bed. 10 years. She hated it and all it represented. Senseless loss, inhuman cruelty in service to misdirected causes. 10 years she had carried it as the world went on, attempting to replace people who would never be replaced. She should just get rid of it. It hurt so much. She felt lighter with it removed, but also inexplicably worse. She righted the effigy, standing it up on her bed, the twisted girders so hot they singed her fingertips. She remembered the searing heat of the blast, her ears popping, the jagged slice of metal piercing her thigh, and the worst of it, her mother. The newborn welts on her back and neck seemed now not so bad. She peered down at the rubble, the street, the body lying on the pavement. Her mother turned over, pulled by the unseen hand of a child. Her mother had only time for one last silent glance. That same look. "I'm all right, mother," Hazal reassured her through clenched teeth. "I'm all right." Soon thereafter, police cleared Gezi Park using tear gas and water cannons. Yusuf arranged for her to take a clerical job at the Ministry of Culture and Tourism. It was menial work and short pay, but Hazal went along with an eye towards attending university. She had an interest in organic chemistry and pharmacology. Higher education became a sore spot between them. Her father was staunchly opposed. She already had a perfectly fine job, he said, and she should think about marriage instead. Perhaps he could introduce her to a suitable companion. He knew several unmarried men at the Dianet. His views were absolutely Byzantine. He would not pay the tuition, though he had the money. In time, she was passed over twice for promotion at the office, and on both occasions she knew, because she was a woman. When she felt helpless, she curled around the disaster and tasted true helplessness. When she wanted only to give up, she embraced its fire. That was true death. The flames reminded her instead that she was alive. She must never quit. She told her father she was going to university, no matter what he said and no matter what it took. He flew into a rage. She balled her fist at him. She would not let him beat her again. "Leave, then," he shouted. "Nankor, and you'll take nothing but the clothes on your back, and you will never set foot in this house again." And so she left, taking only the clothes on her back and the disaster in her chest. She had not seen her father in 5 years. The disaster, with all its attendant pain and loss, had sent him on a course paralleling the descent of Erdogan's Turkey, a blinding spiral towards intolerance and oppression. she had chosen a different path. There was a place reserved for him at the family plot just to the left of her mother's grave. She wondered if one day he would lie down there, or perhaps he would take a different place with Rashida. And still, sitting patiently on the ground before her, the disaster smoldered. 20 years, she said. Is it time, Mother? Her mother didn't answer. She couldn't. She wasn't here. Time to go. Hazal reached down for the disaster. In trying to pick it up, a jagged edge cut her finger. She pressed the edges of her bleeding flesh together, and that, she thought, was answer enough. Not the first time it had cut her, but it would be the last. She bent forward and kissed her mother's headstone. She stood up, coiled the chenille mat into a tube. Hazal noticed a few wisps of black smoke rising from the next grave over. The middle-aged man moved instinctively to block her view, but she recognized the little effigy of Elgin Street he had placed before the gravesite. He, in turn, noticed she had left her own there on the ground. They both looked at it, watching as it sputtered, the fire cooling, the corrupted walls of the synagogue and shops withering away until, having grown paper thin, the sea breeze took them. In the end, nothing remained but a tiny smudge of rapidly dispersing gray ash. The man pursed his lips, and a half nod passed between them, and that was all. He turned back to his mourning and the care and feeding of his own disaster. It was a short walk back to the car.
Mommy!
Little Miriam exclaimed, jouncing in her car seat. Yes, dear. Everything go okay? Karam asked. Yes. Hazal wiped a tear from her eye. 20 years is long enough. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.